This is Wade Rathke. That means it's Friday morning. It's Wade's World. KABF 88.3. www.kbf.org. We're going to be live streaming. This is 100,000 watts of people power. Podcast will be out Monday or Tuesday. And in Wade's World, we talk to the most interesting people in the world. Today, we're talking to Steve Early. He's in Richmond, California, but he's well known as a labor journalist and organizer of long standing with CWA, and even back to the mine workers. Steve, welcome to Wade's World.
Thanks for having me on, Wade.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Look, yesterday was May Day, so I didn't see too many reports of people marching in the streets. Were they doing so in California?
Well, they don't call it the left coast for nothing out here. Yes, there was quite a bit of May Day activity in the Bay Area, in Northern California. I'd say the biggest march and rally was down in San Jose, where there was a lot of immigrant worker participation, and I think it's very interesting to see how May Day continues to take hold as a second Labor Day here in the U.S. Certainly the protests and rallies and marches around the country were not as big as they were on May Day in 2006, but people really are celebrating it on an annual basis in ways that certainly would have been unthinkable only 25 years ago.
Well, that's good news. And, of course, it's news to hear it here because pretty much if you looked at any papers, I saw one mention in any of the national papers, a little squib about 40,000 in Istanbul defying the ban from the government there on a May Day protest, and still 40,000 came up and eye to eye at the, you know, water hoses and gas canisters. But if there was a simple way to sum up the current state of the labor movement here in the U.S., what in the world would that be, Steve?
Well, I think the circumstances of workers, whether they have unions or not, are not very great at the moment. One of the biggest threats, obviously, is the recovery that we're making from the current recession seems to have left us with more jobs that pay less and with fewer benefits. You know, the recession, as the New York Times reported earlier this week, has wiped out millions of higher and middle-income jobs. And the recovery that's underway has really been strongest in the low-wage sector, fast food and service sector. So one major challenge, whether you have union protection and bargaining rights or like 89% of the workforce unfortunately don't, you know, we have an economy now that's replaced good jobs with less desirable ones from a pension and benefit standpoint. So that's a huge organizing challenge if people are going to change that situation.
Well, and I read the same piece probably because the numbers were just amazing. 2.2 million low-wage jobs were lost in recession, but now we've gained 3.8. So we've almost doubled the number of low-wage jobs, supposedly, you know, in quotation marks, coming out of the recession. Your most recent book is called Save Our Unions, which kind of speaks to what probably your view is. Is there something that needs to be saving, that we need to do to save our unions?
Well, I think there's a number of things we need to do, some that unions themselves have to do to kind of get their act together better. Certainly, unions are not going to save themselves by themselves, and part of the argument of the book is that we have to do, as organized labor, a lot more to build durable and effective coalitions with the community, with students, with environmentalists, with women's groups, with low-income and immigrant workers organizations, with all of those elements in society that represent some aspect of the working class majority in this country, not necessarily as workplace-based advocates, but who have common interests with the 15 or 16 million Americans who still have the right to bargain about their pay and benefits and conditions. So if we build more of those alliances, we're going to be on the road to recovery at some point.
Now, I know you've followed closely the organization of a number of worker centers around the country, and I know you and I have talked about activity in Vermont and a number of others, but what do you think we should look for in that area?
Well, the worker centers are really, really important because as the institutional labor movement, the unions that have bargaining rights and that represent workers in established unionized workplaces have shrunk, as a huge vacuum been created, particularly for those millions of undocumented workers and workers in low-wage jobs with low levels of unionization. And many of them have turned to these community-based worker centers, which advocate on their behalf, which help them get organized, put pressure on their employers to improve their pay and their benefits and conditions, which give them advice about their legal rights, which is very important because, you know, we have a lot of rights on paper in this country as individual workers, but without the backing of a union or some other sort of workers' organization, it's often very hard to enforce those rights. So the worker centers really play an important role and hopefully will be a catalyst to the revival of a broader and more effective labor movement.
Because many of them are most effective as advocates. These are not necessarily in the main membership organizations, or to the degree they are. The membership is actually somewhat small in many of the areas, though they have an outsized importance in terms of being advocates for immigrant workers and others, don't they?
True. I think when you don't have people working close together, side by side, every day in the same workplace for the same particular employer, it's very hard, as you know from your own lengthy organizing experience, to sustain durable, voluntary dues-paying membership organizations. Some of the worker centers have been able to do that. The Taxi Drivers Alliance in New York does have a system where people pay dues even though they're not covered by a union contract and the money's not deducted from their paychecks automatically. Some of the others have had less success doing this, and there's higher turnover, and they're more dependent on outside financial assistance from foundations and unions to maintain their day-to-day operations.
I know I did some work a couple of years ago with CASA de Maryland, which has four or five very strong worker centers, obviously, in Maryland, and helped them build a membership program. They now have 10,000 members in sort of a side organization. I think there's some interesting experiments going on there. Speaking of experiments, though, I know you spent many years as a representative with the Communication Workers of America. A couple of months ago on Wage World, we had some people on talking about what's been a hugely lengthy, difficult struggle to organize airport reservations people at American Airlines. Have you kept up with that?
I have, and hopefully there'll be some exciting news very shortly. This has been a 15-year campaign that began with a nationwide representation election among American Airlines Passions of Service employees 15 years ago. The union was defeated, but the workers were not. They maintained an organization of the sort we just described. People joined voluntarily. They advocated on behalf of themselves around a wide range of workplace issues. They continued to build a network of union supporters. And now, 15 years later, they're going to get another shot at winning bargaining rights for a nationwide group of 10 to 15,000 workers. The math has improved a little bit as a result of the U.S. Air American Airlines merger. The passenger service employees at U.S. Air are already unionized. So now that the two groups are being put together, there's a very good chance that sometime in the next few months we'll have another vote and we'll have one of the biggest labor movement victories of the year.
And you probably know some of the issues there. I mean, a lot of the public's view is that, you know, they look at the news reports on how much money a pilot makes, which can be six figures, and they just assume everybody's doing great on the airlines. But that's not been the case. Work has been outsourced. People have worked out of their home. I mean, it's not an easy position on the reservation side, is it?
It definitely is not. And having seen the change in the composition of the workforce over the last 15 years at American and other airlines, as you noted, one of the big concerns is outsourcing. 15 years ago, the workers in this group were a mix of the people you run into at the airport, at the ticket counters and the gates, and call center workers, people who dealt with you on the phone. Well, we know today what voicemail hell dealing with the airlines can be, and where you still have a live person. Very often it's someone talking to you from a non-union call center and perhaps one that's been outsourced overseas. So tens of thousands of jobs in the airline industry have been lost among people who are not making what airline pilots make, as much as they deserve the good pay they get. So there's a lot of job insecurity and a lot of feeling that, you know, workers, when they have these big mega mergers between carriers like US Air and American Airlines, they need a collective voice. And only those who have a union really have a seat at the table, the flight attendants, the pilots, the mechanics, and the baggage handlers at many airlines. If the passenger service people aren't in a union, decisions are going to be made about their future. They're going to have no voice in it.
So this could be a shot in the arm because this will be a big election when it happens, and it should happen soon. It could be one of the biggest union elections we see this year. Recently, we had a big election, though, in Chattanooga with United Automobile Workers looking like they were going to break through with a what's called a trans plant, a VW, Volkswagen plant that's there in Chattanooga with a couple thousand workers. You followed that at all? Because this is an ongoing story. It looks like the leadership pulled away from the objections after a narrow defeat, but this is going to be important in the South.
Well, it is a very important situation. I did have the opportunity to meet two rank-and-file workers from the Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga about a month ago at the Nationwide Labor Notes Conference in Chicago, and they reported on the long struggle there to build a union. As you know, one of the unusual aspects of this effort was the alliance between the United Auto Workers, which was petitioning to represent
Brian
the
did a good
there,
job there.
And the German union,
Metal Workers,
which has a lot of clout and influence within Volkswagen as a global firm. And
including a seat on the board, right, Steve?
Correct, yeah. Under German labor law, called co-determination, workers through their union and sometimes directly can have a voice even on the supervisory boards of companies. So the German union lobbied the management of Volkswagen in the U.S. to remain neutral when workers in Chattanooga voted on whether or not to have the UAW bargain for them. And the company, from all reports at the plant level, pretty much went along with that, but outside third parties did not. And as you know, some conservative politicians, local, state, and federal, in the state of Tennessee, weighed in very heavily, kind of conducted their own scare campaign about the plant losing state subsidies and new investment if the workers unionize. And so by a narrow margin, unfortunately, the workers turned down this time the opportunity to bargain with the employer through the auto workers.
I actually, you know, and this won't surprise you, Steve, but sort of have a contrarian view on Bob King having pulled away from the objections hearing. To me, that says they probably did an assessment with their committee and believe that their support still is going to be strong enough to take a quicker election. I mean, they'd wanted to just save face. They'd probably had a couple of years of litigation ahead of them, which they could say there's a heartbeat. But I also would bet that since, as you say, the governor pulled back on a $300 million incentive commitment to Volkswagen to add the additional production line to that plant. When it gets behind the scenes and Volkswagen is really talking to the governor of Tennessee, are they going to tell him that if they're going to add another line and another 1,500 workers, he's going to have to keep his nose out of their business? So I actually think they've got a shot still if they want to come back. But, you know, we'll see. But you and I are believers in the long march here. So my contrarian view just may be my fantasy forced onto paper. But
well, I think the sad thing about this is that the majority of the workers, as of last summer, clearly wanted a union. The UAW signed a majority of the workers up in the plant as of last summer. And the employer, if it really wanted to be fair and neutral, should have recognized the union based on that what we call card majority. Instead, there was a protracted and overly secretive negotiating process about what the election ground rules would be early this year. And during that time, those who wanted to thwart unionization inside the plant and outside were able to scare a certain number of the workers in the plant about the consequences of voting for a union. And the employers in this country have the option, they've had it since 1935, to voluntarily recognize new unions when the majority of workers sign cards. And that's why those of us who supported the labor law reform known as card check believe that that step should be enough. It should be required that employers recognize new unions based on not showing a majority support. And the second step of going to an election, particularly under these circumstances, does not really serve the purposes of the National Labor Relations Act, in my view.
That's exactly right. And we're talking on Wage World today with Steve Early, labor activist, organizer, representative, and author now, including of a recent book called Save Our Unions. Steve, talking about using global influence and the strength of the German labor movement, you wrote a very interesting piece that led a issue of Social Policy not too long ago on the organizing of the effort to organize T-Mobile and how that involves some global leverage. Where does that stand now, or what's your view of how that really worked or didn't work?
Well, it's an ongoing campaign. As some of your listeners may know, may even be T-Mobile customers. T-Mobile is a nationwide wireless cell phone company, has about 25,000 workers, only a handful of them, and two small groups in the Northeast are union represented. The rest in call centers and retail stores and in technical units do not have bargaining rights. And for 10 years, a very valiant group of about 800 workers have built a workers' organization within the firm with support both from the Communication Workers of America and another German union called Verdi, which is the telephone and service sector union in Germany. And again, like the metal workers trying to put some pressure on Volkswagen to behave in this country and really live up to the higher labor standards of Europe, our German union partner has tried to put pressure on T-Mobile management here to respect workers' rights to organize. And while the workers at T-Mobile have not yet won the kind of union contract protections that their counterparts at AT&T Mobility have, they have been able to make some progress around particular issues, one of them being getting federal benefits when a number of T-Mobile call centers were closed throughout the country a year or two ago and that work outsourced overseas.
Well, and I know that campaign goes on for my own part because I was in Texas a couple of weeks ago and stumbled onto what looks like a T-Mobile organizing blitz that CWA is running, either already has or soon. So clearly they continue to try to light the fires there with that company. Speaking of all that, though, I mean, solidarity globally and whether or not that's going to help us, we've had some problems with solidarity in the U.S. And I know one of the books you wrote was about labor civil wars, and some of them are in your new homestead, Northern California. SEIU and National Hospital Workers and all that. I mean, this is not something probably most people with listening to Wage World know about, but it's a very important struggle. Why don't you give people some sense of that, Steve?
Well, a few years ago, as you know, primarily between 2008, 2010, 11, some of the unions that nationally had developed a reputation as being the most progressive in the country, being the most oriented towards new organizing, fell out among themselves and engaged in a very bitter and costly and disruptive series of intra-union conflicts, primarily in the healthcare industry in California, but also in other parts of the country as well. And tens of millions of dollars were spent on competitive union representation election battles. This is not an ideal situation, obviously, in a period when organized labor overall is shrinking. I can report lately that the new National Union of Healthcare Workers in California, which broke away from the service employees 5 years ago, has been concentrating, per your advice perhaps, on organizing the unorganized in California and has won a series of 7 or 8 representation election victories in among hospital workers and nursing home workers. And I think it's important sometimes to have more than one union in a field. Sometimes that kind of friendly competition can improve the performance of the bigger union in the field, having a smaller, perhaps more militant, democratic, and member-oriented organization organizing as well. But it's certainly probably best at this point for people to cooperate rather than compete if the labor movement wants to survive.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a painful irony that we're down to, what, 5%, we're maybe 7, maybe 6.9, I forget the last figure, of the private sector in terms of union representation, and yet as few as we have, we're, you know, not able to agree on how to organize the unorganized. There's certainly room for big unions, room for people a part of institutional labor, as you and I call it, the AFL, and now there's another federation, Change to Win, and a number of independents. We've got a lot of room for people to organize without stepping on anybody's toes with 89% or more of the, you know, American workforce unorganized. And this is a global phenomenon, too. Unions are not getting stronger virtually anywhere. So we need to keep putting pieces together. And that's, speaking of the Labor Notes Conference, that's usually a topic of hot discussion there as well, eh, Steve?
Very definitely. Labor Notes, for those of your listeners who have not run across it, has been around for 35 years, which is quite a record in long-distance running, organizationally speaking. It started out as a monthly newsletter providing information to labor activists around the country and then evolved into a kind of independent labor education project. And it has national conferences every 2 years. And notwithstanding the very daunting circumstances of organized labor today, about a month ago in Chicago, 2,000 people came. Biggest turnout.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's huge.
Very strong contingents from the Amalgamated Transit Union, the bus drivers union, postal workers, which has a new activist organizing-oriented national president, the Chicago teachers, which had a big strike several years ago and is in a continuing struggle to defend public education there, brought a large delegation. So you really had some very impressive leaders, including a couple who are on the AFL-CIO Executive Council and some important leaders of locals in the private and public sector around the country. And it was a great event, very inspiring. I think people went away with some new ideas for how to strengthen their unions back home.
What's happening with, you know, one of the key unions that's always been identified with Labor Notes and sort of the more rank-and-file progressive wing has always been Teamsters for Democratic Union, TDU. Let's talk about long-distance runners. That's been a long one. I'm sure they were there.
TDU was very well represented, and one of the campaigns that it was highlighting has actually, since the conference, come to a successful conclusion. There were 250 UPS drivers in New York City fired by the company several months ago as a result of a one-day unauthorized work stoppage, a job protest that had to do with mistreatment of the drivers by UPS management. The company retaliated by firing all 250 workers, and this became a big New York City labor cause celebre. Members of the city council, the new mayor, lots of community groups, and most important of all, UPS customers all joined the protest. As of the time of the Labor Notes Conference, they had not been reinstated, but since then they have. And even the National Union, International Brotherhood of Teamsters, got involved in putting some pressure on the company to make this bad situation right. So I think it's both unusual that people engage in that kind of strike activity today during the life of a contract. Company certainly overreacted in how it punished them, and now those workers have been reinstated to their jobs, and by the standards of the day, that is a labor victory.
Well, by the standards of any day, because one of the things I love about that particular story is those 250 drivers went out on strike to protest the firing of one of their leaders who had stood up to the company and acting as a steward. And You know, the old injury to one is an injury of all to all, which was one of the guiding lights and beacons for so long in the labor movement, is just too often lost in this sort of legalese of collective bargaining and, you know, what you can and can't do and this, that, and the other. So to see 250 well-paid, hardworking UPS Teamster workers go out in solidarity for one of their leaders, that's something we can be proud of, as they say in the country western songs. I mean, that was a great victory. Look, speaking of all that, I noticed, you know, I know you're working on a new book, Steve, and we're talking to Steve Early, labor activist, journalist, organizer, and author, about Richmond. And we've had some people from the Richmond Progressive Alliance on Wade's World before, but it looks like you're looking at a book about Richmond and some of the politics and activity there.
Well, Richmond is a very interesting city in what's called the East Bay, San Francisco Bay area. It's across from San Francisco itself, just up the coast from the better-known city of Oakland and Berkeley. Richmond has been for 110 years the home of a major oil refinery, now owned and operated by Chevron. And for many years, it was a company town. The company wielded enormous influence over the politics and the social life of the community. About 10, 12 years ago, that started to change. A grassroots coalition called the Richmond Progressive Alliance started electing some people to the city council. And for the last 8 years, a wonderful mayor, Gail McLaughlin, who's a member of the California Greens. And for the first time, really, in the town's history, there was a major effort to hold the largest employer in town, Chevron, more accountable to the people and to start addressing issues related to refinery safety and pollution and other negative impacts of having this kind of facility in our midst. So there's a big battle right now. This is an election year to determine whether City Hall will remain in the hands of the progressive movement and the people of the city, or whether Chevron's going to retake Richmond and turn the clock back and make it some kind of company town again.
Well, and I think one of the candidates for mayor you shared with me has a big connection to Labor Notes that we were just talking about, too, doesn't he?
Correct. We have a system here in California where you get termed out, as it's called. Our current mayor is finishing up 2 4-year terms in January, so she is not able to run again as for mayor. She's running for the city council. And so our friend and neighbor, Mike Parker, is worked as an auto worker for 25 years, retired, moved here to Richmond, has been an organizer for the Richmond Progressive Alliance for the last 7 years, and an important ally of the current mayor, is running for mayor on a four-member progressive slate. And really the outcome of the election will determine whether Richmond continues to be a source of interesting progressive policy initiatives at the municipal level.
Steve, this has been a great May Day, immersion for all of our listeners. I want you to tell people about your book, Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress, and particularly how they can get a copy.
Well, the book is published by Monthly Review Press. You can read more about it at a personal website I have, steveearly.org, or you can go to the Monthly Review .org website and order a copy directly there. I highly recommend that people avoid an online bookseller known as Amazon. If you are buying online, please go to Powell's in Portland, a unionized bookseller.
By our friends with the ILWU, exactly right. We've been talking. We're going to have to get. You know, we're going to have to make this a tradition of Wade's World, is get you on for every show that's close to May Day, because and maybe we can survey from year to year whether or not we have progress in our beloved labor movement. But this has been Wade's World, KBF 88.3 on FM dial, 100,000 watts of people power. This has been Wade's World. We interview and talk to the most interesting people in the world. Next week, we're going to have somebody from an international organization, also based in the West Coast, who's written about why the Koch brothers with 1 million acres in Alberta, Canada, really want to build Keystone XL, which also dumped the same oil tar stands that dumped in Mayflower, Arkansas. In solidarity, all of our Mayflower friends in the broadcast area who are suffering from the tornado, as well as everyone else in Arkansas. This has been Wage World. We'll see you next Friday, 9 a.m. Over and out.